products liability and complex pharmaceutical and medical devices cases. She has successfully litigated against big companies like Ford, Motor Company, Johnson & Johnson, Boston Scientific, Procter & Gamble, Texaco, and etc., and obtained substantial compensation for consumers injured by unsafe business practices and products. She works closely with experts in various fields, including pulmonology, gynecology, epidemiology, neurology, and industrial hygiene. موضوع سخنرانی امشبشون هم کانسومر سیفتی هستش که توضیح میدن هفته آینده سوم آگست استثنان آقای دکتر سروش هستن، معمولا ایشون جمعه سوم هستن ولی استثنان هفته آینده هستن. دهم آگست آقای بازرگان، هفدهم آقای اویسی و بقیه هم خدمتون اعلام میکنیم زمانی که نزدیکتر میشیم. واسه همین لود کنید همگی یک کف برای دانش آموز اسبق بنده بزنید.
Salam to Hamegi. Thank you, Aga Mogari, for introducing me. As Aga Mogari had mentioned, given the technical matter of this, I'm going to have to go and speak English if that's okay with everyone. But I'm very happy to be here today. I'm very happy to be here today, and it truly is an honor to come and speak with everyone today. I recognize some familiar faces and a lot of people I haven't seen in a very long time, but I'm happy to be here today. And so my goal tonight is to provide you with some basic knowledge and tools so that you can use the next time you go to a doctor's office and you get treatment. And so that way you can become active, involved, and informed in the decisions that you are relating to your healthcare or that of a family member. So typically what happens is a lot of us will go to the doctor's office, we'll list all of our symptoms, the doctor will tell us what's wrong, and then write a prescription, and we, having trust in these doctors, we go ahead and follow their recommendation with often very little questions asked. And so this is something that we commonly do. I know I've done it multiple times before, particularly before I got involved in the work that I'm involved in now. And you might think, well, what's wrong with that? The problem with this is to illustrate the danger of taking such a passive approach in your healthcare decisions. I want to briefly talk about a drug that's called Zofran. So Zofran was actually approved by the FDA in 1991. It was actually for cancer patients. It was people who they were undergoing radiation and chemotherapy, and as a result, they were experiencing severe nausea and vomiting. And so Zofran was approved by the FDA to combat that, but it was specific to cancer patients because it had been determined that that the risks were outweighed by the benefits. However, the company started to heavily market and promote their drug, Zofran, as a safe treatment for use during pregnancy for women who were experiencing morning sickness. Okay, so I know, for example, when I was pregnant, I had some morning sickness. I know pretty much everyone has had, a lot of people have had morning sickness as expecting mothers. So this was a drug that was being promoted, and a lot of physicians were prescribing this medication. And it became very popular. In fact, over 1 million pregnant women every year were being prescribed Zofran. So you would think that with such a popular drug, that there must be studies out there that show that it's in fact safe to be used in pregnant women. And believe it or not, that is not the case. It is far from the case. There were absolutely no studies showing that Zofran is safe to be used during pregnancy. It was never approved by the FDA for treating morning sickness in pregnant women. The company, though, they saw it as a huge moneymaker because there was no other drug on the market for them to compete with when it came to morning sickness. So they went so far as to pay doctors millions of dollars to encourage them to promote and prescribe Zofran to pregnant women. And this is in clear violation of federal laws, but it happened anyways. This isn't a unique situation. This actually happens a lot of the time, unfortunately. For Zofran, the company, GlaxoSmithKline, had actually performed animal studies and had determined that it was in fact unsafe to be used during pregnancy. A lot of the animals that were being tested, they were born with, the offspring were born with malformities. So what is the result of this? You have children born of cleft palate and heart defects. And these required surgery. They were oftentimes fatal. And this happened to thousands and thousands of babies out there. And had these women, these patients, had they known about this? Had they known that there were no studies out there? Had they known about these risks? Most people would not have taken it. It depends on the severity of the morning sickness, but a lot of people, for example, myself, I would never take it because I would say, while I'm not feeling well, it's not worth that. It's not worth my child being born with a heart defect or having to undergo a surgery because they have cleft palate. So this sort of blind trust that we place in our doctors to make decisions for us, it's really a result of a number of factors. And one is a hesitancy to ask questions because we don't want to come off as if we are challenging our doctors. We don't want to offend our doctor. There's also a hesitancy to ask questions because, you know, nowadays you have 15 minutes to see your doctor before they have to go and see the next patient. So you're kind of in a rush to get the information and to basically get out of there. And then particularly, though, in Iranian culture, another reason is that there's a large deference given to doctors. And in terms of them being basically almost all-knowing when it comes to health. And so my intention is not to scare you into never taking a drug again. And my intention is not to replace your doctor in any way. I'm certainly not a medical professional. You should always seek the advice of your doctor. But what I intend to show, and my point tonight, and what I hope to show, is that there are limitations in what is available to your doctors. And so there are... that are available to your doctors, and so that you can have a basic understanding of the American medical and regulatory system so that the next time you go to the doctor's office and you're recommended a particular course of treatment, you can make an informed, educated decision with your doctor.
That's up. You want us to hold the questions, or can ask you?
Probably hold the questions. So since I'll be kind of going over a lot of new information, I thought I'd provide you kind of with an outline as to what I would be talking about. And I want to start out with what regulations are in place, what government agencies are in place to ensure these products are in fact safe and effective. And also how it is that these types of regulations came about. Why is it that we have the food drug and the FDA? And I also want to talk about what it means today in terms of what the FDA is required to do, or what the companies are required to do, what they're not required to do, and also what are the limitations of the FDA in ensuring our safety as consumers and as patients. And I'd also, once we have that information, I'd like to provide you with some of the questions that you might want to ask your doctors, some steps that you might want to take next time you go and visit your doctor, or after you visit your doctor, when you're deciding whether or not to, when you're making a decision regarding your medical treatment. And then lastly, I want to offer basically an introduction about what the American legal system offers in the case that you have an unwanted complication from a drug or a medical device. Okay, so the FDA, probably everyone here has heard of it, or at least knows that there's an agency out there that exists that does what the FDA does. But it basically regulates drugs and medical devices. That's one thing that they do. But they basically came in play because of these tragedies, thousands of deaths, deformities, all of these tragic situations as a result of drugs that were out there. So the first one I want to start with, it goes way back, it's from 1937, but it's called the elixir sulfanilamide. And this was a disaster that essentially acted as the catalyst for the creation of the FDA as we know it today. So sulfanilamide was an antibiotic drug. And it's used fairly safely when it came in the form of a tablet, of a pill, or for a powder. A company by the name of the Massengill Company, they wanted to differentiate themselves from all the competitors that they had. And so they found out that there was a demand for having this drug in a liquid form. And the reason for that is there were a lot of children who were getting infections, and it was hard for them to take the pill. So a syrup was the way that they thought that they could market their product. And so they found a way to, but it was particularly difficult to dissolve into water or into a liquid. And so they experimented a bit, and the researchers eventually found found that their powder would dissolve with diethylene glycol. So they took, diethylene glycol is what we know today as antifreeze. It's that thing that goes in our car. And that was added to this product. And while it's very good for a car, it is highly poisonous for anyone ingesting it. And so this led to the immediate death of hundreds of people. And most of them were kids, unfortunately. And what happened was, though, Massengill claimed, well, we didn't know. And you wonder, well, how is it that you didn't know? Well, the only testing that they did was to test for its taste and to see if it looked good, if it appeared nice. They added some raspberry and caramel for flavoring, and they knew that a child would like that. That's kind of how they would get a child to take down the medicine. And so that's the testing that they did. They never actually tested for the safety of their product. And so they didn't actually break any laws at that time, because there was no requirement at that time to test for safety. And so basically they got a slap on the wrist, but you know, they have all these kids that have died. And had they done just simple testing on just animals, had they done some testing on mice, they would have quickly discovered how poisonous this product was. And they didn't do that. And so after that, there was a public outcry. And it caused the Congress to enact what is the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. This is essentially what led to establishment of the FDA as we know it today. And it gave the FDA, for the first time, the authority to require that drugs prove their safety before it gets onto the market, before people like you and I and our children take a product. So that was the first time. Before that, it was a free-for-all. You just had to basically be truthful about what was in your product, but that was the extent of it. But the issue with that is that companies still did not have to prove that their drug was effective. So it could be safe, but it didn't actually have to do the thing it was saying it had to do. So for an antibiotic, they didn't actually have to prove that it would treat an infection. So that was still left completely unregulated. So this requirement didn't actually come into play until the 1960s. And again, this was a result of a tragedy that took place. And so that was a result of a drug called thalidomide. And I don't know if you guys can see this, but essentially this was given to women who, pregnant women, as a sleeping pill. And it ended up with thousands of babies being born without limbs. And this is, again, one of those instances that could have easily been prevented. And so this, again, caused the public outcry, and essentially it caused Congress to, again, enact stricter laws. And so that now FDA has the authority and the mandate to require drug manufacturers to prove that their drug is also effective. So at that time, you had it kind of different from the time you are right now, where you have everyone basically pushing for regulation, whereas right now we kind of see some deregulation. And so that's where we ended up with after that tragedy. So where are we left now? So what does it mean when a drug has FDA approval? You might see that when there's a commercial. You might see that at the bottom. You might see that when you're at a doctor's office and they have those little pamphlets that describe a new drug, and they'll say FDA approved. Well, what does that mean? So that just means that the company has done significant amount of testing, clinical trials on humans, to make sure that the product is in fact safe and effective. So something that didn't occur before and now is occurring, and it's intended to protect consumers. And if a drug has been approved, so if your doctor, for example, if a drug has been approved, that basically means the FDA looked at the studies that were provided to it by the company and determined the risks are outweighed by the benefits, basically the treatment that the drug will provide to whatever the condition is. But what does FDA approval not mean? So this is just a list of everything, but basically, when you go to your doctor's office and you're prescribed something, that doesn't necessarily mean it's been approved for that use. And we saw that when I was talking to you guys about Zofran. So Zofran was approved for use in cancer patients. It was not approved for use in pregnant women to counter morning sickness. That was not it. But there's no law against doctors to prescribe what's called off-label, meaning that it's for something other than when it's been approved. And we've seen the disastrous effects that can have sometimes. It's not always the case, but it can. And the reason for that is because there's no studies done on it. So when you do find out the side effects, it's after the drugs have been prescribed and put on the market, even before there have been any sort of testing. The second major misconception is that we believe that companies, when they put a product out in the market, they have to tell us everything. They have to tell us the good and the bad. It's actually not the case. They, to get FDA approval, they just have to show two favorable studies. So take a company, and these companies do a lot of studies. So take a company, they say they do 10 studies, okay? 8 of them have negative results. Either show that the drug is not safe or it's not effective, but 2 of them show favorable results. They only have to turn over the 2 favorable studies to the FDA. So they can basically bury negative and unfavorable findings and prevent people like your doctor or us as patients, as consumers, from ever finding out this information. And unfortunately, most of the time, this comes to light as a result of litigation after several thousands of people have been injured. And it's because a drug manufacturer has withheld information, hasn't done the testing, or has done testing and found it was actually unsafe. There's also a misconception that when a new drug comes out on the market, that it must be better than whatever is already on the market, and that's not true at all. So to get FDA approval, you don't at all have to show that your product is safe, that your drug is safer, or that it works any better than a drug that's been on the market for 20 years. You just have to show it's safe and effective. So that leaves physicians in a bind because, well, that's not very useful to them. They want to know, is this new drug better? Is it safer? Is it more effective? And so this information is not actually provided to the doctor. And so what they essentially do when companies There's two ways that companies do trials. They'll either set a group of people, for example, 50 of 100 subjects, 50 of them will get the new drug, and the other 50 will get what's called a placebo. It's basically a sugar pill, okay? And so that's how they figure out if the drug is safe and effective. But they don't have to actually do it up against another drug. But when they use a sugar pill, all that tells you is that it's more effective than doing absolutely nothing. That doesn't actually tell the physician, it doesn't provide the physician with any helpful information. There are other trials that can be done and that some companies will do where they'll compare their drug with that of an existing drug. But what has often been the case, unfortunately, is that they'll skew the results. They'll design the study in a way that they'll come back with favorable results. So, for example, let's say you have an antidepressant drug that you're taking. Well, a company comes out with a new drug, and to make their drug seem safer, they'll give their drug at the lowest dose. The lowest dose is just effective. But then they'll give their competitive drug, a extremely high dose, at basically the highest level that you can. And they do that because the poison is in the dose. The more you give someone something, the more likely you're going to see some adverse effects to it. So essentially as a way to manipulate the data and make it seem like their drug is safer than what's already been out on the market. There's also no requirement for the company to do pre-market testing to see how the drug works in the population that they're actually that will actually be using it. So, say for example, you have a new drug and it's an antidepressant, but it can be used by young adults all the way to someone who's 80 years old. Okay, but what they will do often is they will test their product. The pre-market testing will be limited to people, to subjects who are healthy, who are otherwise healthy, who, for example, don't have any other issues. They don't have heart disease, they don't have diabetes or whatever it is. And they'll also take younger individuals. But that's not what's reflective of the real world. That's not the people who are actually going to be taking the drug. And so that's a way to make it seem, to kind of skew the data. And the other thing, though, to keep in mind is the FDA, we think that the government, in protecting us, has all the resources available to do so. It's actually not the case, particularly with the FDA. They are very restricted in their budget and in their staffing, and they don't actually independently test the drugs and medical devices. They have to rely on the information provided to them by the manufacturers. And as I've discussed before, the manufacturer doesn't actually have to turn over all of this information. So they're basically being given only the information that's favorable to the company. And so they don't have the capacity or the ability to go out there and test and confirm that every drug is in fact safe or and effective. So another thing I'd like to, that a lot of people don't know is that, and I'm not saying, are there any doctors here? Okay. And anybody who has a family member who is a doctor? So, and I'm not saying this is true of you or anyone that you know, but an unfortunate reality in our current system is that physicians are allowed to take payment from pharmaceutical companies. And this creates an inherent conflict of interest. And the only thing that they now have to do is they just have to report it. And so there's a website, there's a federal agency that they have to report it to. But there's a study that's been done that says that more than 60% of doctors have a financial relationship with a pharmaceutical company. And to see why that can be problematic, I want to talk to you guys about the company Bayer. They have a birth control device. It's a permanent device that's implanted. It's called Esher. And this actually recently came out. So this one woman, her name is Christina Potts, she was looking for a permanent birth control. She goes to her doctor, and her doctor is like a major cheerleader of this one and only device. It's only Assure. That's all he wants to, that's the only thing he wants to recommend. And so she ended up taking the advice of her doctor, the recommendation, and she had it implanted. It left her in terrible pain, and it was so excruciating that she ended up having to have a hysterectomy and her tubes tied in order to get the eSure product out of her. And she later learned that her doctor was one of many doctors who had received significant payments from the company Bayer. And Bayer had actually paid over 12,000 physicians $2.5 million in just a five-year time span in consulting fees and in other fees to basically get people to promote their product and to prescribe their product. And this particular doctor, she had received almost $100,000 for a single product. So the question becomes, when I go to my doctor and they prescribe me something, if I go to my doctor and they recommend a particular treatment, are they doing it because it's the best product, it's the best treatment for me, or are they doing it because there is a financial interest, a conflict of interest? And again, this isn't the case for every doctor. It's not, more often than not, it's not, but you do want to be aware of that. And there are things that you can do, and I'll discuss later on in terms of how to verify whether or not that actually is the case. So that when you go do see your doctor, you can figure out, okay, does this doctor receive money from a pharmaceutical company? So another concern is that doctors are free to prescribe drugs that are other than what, for conditions other than what's been approved. And that was what I talked about earlier with Zofran. And essentially, one in every five prescriptions are actually for off-label usage. And a lot of the times, doctors actually don't know that it's off-label. It's just so heavily promoted by companies. Even though not supposed to do it, it still happens time and time and again. GlaxoSmithKline is just notorious for this, and they've been fined and been criminally charged multiple times for making false, promoting something that's not, they're not supposed to promote, or paying doctors in excess and not disclosing it. So there's a lot of bad behavior that we just learned about, unfortunately, through litigation. So the FDA, though, doesn't regulate doctors. And again, doctors are free to prescribe the medication that they see fit. And like I mentioned, that a lot of doctors don't actually even know that the drug is off-label. For example, there was a drug called Seroquel, and it was approved for something else, but it was being prescribed by these doctors for dementia, so elderly patients with dementia. And one in five of the physicians that were prescribing it didn't even know that it wasn't allowed for that use, they didn't know that it hadn't gone through safety and efficacy testing for that particular condition. So that's just something to be wary of, is so when you do get a drug or a drug recommended to you by your doctor, you want to ask, is this actually been tested? Have they actually tested to see, is it safe? Is it effective? We've talked a lot about pharmaceutical drugs, so that's the medication that you're taking. There's also medical devices, and that can vary. There's basically three classes, and they're regulated differently, or there's the amount of testing that needs to be done is different. So you get everything from your latex glove to a cardiac, like a pacemaker. So, and in between is where a lot of the devices, medical devices, actually fall, and that's, for example, has anyone here have themselves had a hip replacement or knee replacement, or know someone else who has? Okay. There were several, actually thousands and thousands of women who also had a mesh that was implanted in them after child labor. They would experience incontinence and prolapse, so they had this permanent product implanted in them. It was a mesh implant. So that is a medical device. Now, We talked earlier about the syrup that was caused a whole bunch of deaths, and we had the sleeping pill that caused a whole bunch of deaths. So the pharmaceutical drugs were regulated earlier on, starting in the 1930s. Medical devices, though, they weren't regulated until the 1970s. Actually, it wasn't until 1976. And so once Congress gave the FDA the authority and the mandate to actually check to see whether these drugs are, those medical devices are safe and effective, there were already hundreds of medical devices out on the market. And the FDA did not have the budget or the capacity to go back and check to verify whether or not these medical devices were safe or effective. So what happened is they grandfathered in these medical devices, meaning that these medical devices could stay on the product, it can stay on the market, and they wouldn't have to show their safety or efficacy. And they're called a predicate device. And the unfortunate outcome or the way that it's played out for medical devices and how little it's actually, how low the threshold is to get a medical device on the market has caused a number of complications and tragedies, many of whom I've had to represent, and I can get through those later. But these medical devices, all they have to show, so say for example, a company wants to come out with a new medical device in the year 2000. They just have to show, they don't have to show that it's safe or effective. All they have to show is that it's substantially equivalent to a device that's already out there on the market. But again, a lot of these companies are going back to a device from these predicate devices were between before 1976. And those, again, were not proven to be safe or effective. So you have all these medical devices now on the market that have never, that are based on products that were never shown to be safe or effective. And it's basically what's called, this is called 510K clearance. This is a much easier way to get your product on the market instead of going through the approval process. There are certain exceptions. You can't do this, for example, with a cardiac, like a pacemaker. That's not allowed. That one, that kind of device has to be put through all that rigorous testing that you would see with a pharmaceutical drug. But things like the hip prosthesis and the mesh implants that were, those, none of those had to actually go through clinical human trials. And to give you an idea as to how few medical devices actually have to be tested through clinical trials, it's only 2%. Of all the medical devices. Everything else, 98% of them have gone through the 510K clearance process. Now, why is this a problem though? And the reason why I'm saying again, the limitations of what a doctor may know. I have had a defense expert on the other side, very knowledgeable expert, very recognized in his field, but he didn't know that the product at issue had never actually gone through testing. He thought the clearance process was the same as the approval process. And in there is where there's the danger, is when you don't know as the prescribing doctor that the device or the product that you are recommending to your patient hasn't been tested. How are you supposed to do a risk-benefit analysis if you don't have all of that information? So I know this is a lot of information that I'm throwing at everyone, and it's just basically to kind of give everyone an understanding of some of the assumptions that we're making, and to basically challenge those assumptions and learn some additional facts that will help you from now on to ask the right questions. So what can you do? Probably have you guys scratching your heads at this point, trying to figure out, okay, what do I do to make sure this doesn't happen to me, right? So the best thing that you can do is participate in your treatment. Be active, be involved, be informed. Don't just rely on your doctor. Again, I'm not here to take the place of your doctor, and by no means am I saying that you shouldn't listen to your doctor, but you have a very short period of time often in that visit, and so you want to be prepared. You want to ask questions, okay? So the first thing is learn a little bit about your doctor first. research your doctor. Make sure they're board certified. When you're going, for example, you have an ear infection and you go, you can go to your primary, that's fine to go to a primary care. But if you're going to something more serious for a drug or a surgery that may require a drug that may be more permanent, long-term, that's when you probably want to go see a specialist. A cardiologist, a pulmonologist, whatever it is for the condition that you are seeking treatment. For you also, one thing that you do want to check is you want to make sure that whether or not, like I said earlier, does that doctor have a financial relationship with the company? That way, when you sit down and you're being recommended a particular course of treatment, you can see, well, is there a bias perhaps by this doctor? And you can figure out this information, and you can actually talk to your doctor about it. And they can, so you don't have to just not go to this doctor, but you can also just go to this doctor and ask them about this to make sure that there isn't some sort of bias when they're making a particular recommendation for you. The other thing is take notes. Bring a notepad. It is a lot of information that you get at your doctor's office, particularly when you're being seen for something serious. When you get some, you know, when a doctor tells you, for example, okay, you have a heart disease or you have diabetes or whatever it is that you may have, that's a lot of news. That's something big to take in, right? And it can be scary, and you're thinking probably about 100 different other things. And so, but if you write down some notes, just write down, it'll help you kind of retain that information. But the other thing that you should do is at the end of your visit, kind of go over that notes with your doctor. Because what's happened is there's studies have shown that there was one study, for example, where they interviewed patients right after they had left the doctor's office. And 67% of the patients had completely misunderstood what the doctor had told them. And so talking to your doctor, repeating back and going through your notes with the doctor will help the doctor figure out, okay, well, no, you completely misunderstood. Let me clarify for you. If you have any questions, ask the doctor. This is your time to ask. Do not feel like you're bothering your doctor. Do not feel like your doctor doesn't have time. If you feel that for whatever reason the doctor can't answer your questions during that time, that if it has to go on to another patient, then schedule another visit so you can go over the treatment options more in depth and you can get all of your questions answered. When the doctor tells you what's wrong with you, what the condition is, right? They might automatically tell you, okay, well, here's what I would prescribe. You should ask the doctor, though, what are all my treatment options? What are the alternatives? Okay, so whether it be medicine, a pill, or it be surgery, whatever it is, you want to know even within for pills, you want to make sure, are there other pills out there? Are there other drugs out there that have been on the market for longer? And the reason for that is there's a more complete safety history for those. You know it because it's been on the market for, say, 10, 15 years. So you know how it actually plays out in people like you who are taking the medication. So you should ask your doctor, is this a new drug? So if the doctor gives you a list of different treatments and decides, okay, well, look, this is the one I think is best for you, and you should go over the risks and benefit. Ask the doctor, what are the risks? What are the benefits? And he will say, and he should go over that with you, he or she, I'm sorry, should go over that with you. And when you ask about the side effects, you want to make sure you ask not only about what the side effects are, but are they long-term? How severe are they? How likely are they to actually occur? There are certain things that are pretty rare, but when they do occur, they're permanent, they're chronic. So to give you an example of the one of the litigations I was involved in, it was for the mesh implant that was used for, again, the women who were experiencing incontinence and prolapse after child labor. In the pamphlet and everything that was given to them by the doctor, it says pain as a side effect. And the doctors also, when they thought of pain, they were thinking of the pain that you might experience after having a surgery. A lot of our clients ended up having chronic debilitating pain to the point where some of our clients couldn't sit in a car for more than 10 minutes. They couldn't sit at their desk for more than 20 minutes. Some of them couldn't sit in a chair for very long at all. And this was all, they had no idea that when the company was saying pain, that they meant chronic pain, that they meant some, and then the problem with that is with something that's a medical device that's implanted into you, there's scar tissue, so it actually makes it difficult for you, for the product to later be removed. And so for a lot of our clients, they were left with this pain because the doctors would try to remove the device and it actually wasn't, they weren't able to get the whole thing out. So it's just left in their body and they're left with this pain that they're just now going to have to deal with. Everyone I've spoken with today has pretty much, their English is very, very good. But if you have any problems with English, I would highly recommend asking for a translator to be present, or bring a friend, bring whoever you can to a doctor's visit. Again, not for like an ear infection, I'm talking more about stuff for if you have a heart problem or anything like that. That's a good time for you to ask for a translator. You can ask for a translator for something when you're going for an ear infection, for example, but you know, when you're going to a doctor's office, make sure you have the hospitals, for example, or a lot of facilities will have a translator. But if not, you can always bring a friend or a family member to help you out. And the other thing to do is to for the off-label usage that we talked about, one thing to make sure to ask your doctor is the drug that you are recommending to me, has it been approved for that specific condition? So if I were to use a Zofran, for an example, I would ask my doctor, was Zofran approved by the FDA to treat morning sickness? Are there studies to actually show whether it's safe in pregnant women? Particularly one thing to be aware of with in anyone who is pregnant or has a child that's, you know, pregnant, or someone that recently married and they're thinking about getting pregnant, one thing to be aware of is most drugs have not actually been tested in pregnant women. So the doctor will say, for example, well, there are no known risks. But the fact that there's no risk doesn't mean that there are no known risks, that there are no studies shown to say that there are risks doesn't mean that there actually isn't a risk. So the absence of evidence doesn't mean that there is no risk. So ask your doctor about that. If your doctor doesn't know, it's something that he or she can easily look up actually online. There are websites, the FDA website, and then there's another website by the NIH, and the doctor can easily figure that information out. So there's also, but the most important thing is basically be talked at, not talked to. Make sure you're an active in the whole process. For any of the doctors in the crowd, have you ever been approached by a pharmaceutical sales rep? Probably, yeah. So you'll get the visits and they might be pushing a new drug on you. The one thing I would, you know, be wary of is, particularly given your medical background, you have the ability to look at published articles. So, you know, for everyone else, I probably wouldn't say go to PubMed. You know, you can do a search for peer-reviewed, published articles you can actually look at the studies to see, are they being done long enough where they would actually capture the risks, the side effects that would likely occur. And then that's something that would be really important to talk to your doctors, to your physician, to your patients about. And as a physician, one thing that I would recommend too is actually, if you're being approached by a pharmaceutical sales rep for a new drug, ask them for all of the information, because again, keep in mind they only have to give you guys the favorable results. A lot of times they'll just bury and hide the unfavorable results. So that's just something to be aware of. And that actually protects you down the line from liability, because it's, you know, it's not your fault if a company doesn't tell you the risk and then you then go on and prescribe the product. You didn't know. And had you known, for example, you would, you know, that would affect your risk benefit analysis. So then the question becomes, oh, I'm sorry. So a couple of resources if you want to write this down. WebMD and Mayo Clinic are really good ones to find out about your condition and to also find out about what treatment options are available to you. There's also Kaiser Health News. It's actually not affiliated with Kaiser Insurance Company. It's a nonprofit. It's an independent organization. But these ones are very good at kind of giving you some information, but in layman's terms, and information that you can easily digest. For any doctors or professionals, you can also just go to the FDA website. That's another good one, but it's just kind of harder to navigate. So I would recommend these in terms of kind of learning a little bit more. Be careful about when you go online about what you click on and try and find more information, because a lot of it can be junk. So go to sites like WebMD and Mayo Clinic. These are established, respected websites. Well, Mayo Clinic is a well-established institution. So you want to go to these kind of websites to get more information. And it'll give you information about side effects, about the how likely it is to occur. And then the last one is called Open Payments Database. And what this is how you can figure out if your doctor who's prescribing you a medication or recommending a particular device be implanted, this is how you can check if they have any financial relationship with the company. And so Cindy Buzinski was the doctor I was telling you guys about for that bay that had a that was paid almost $100,000 by Bayer. And here you can see she actually has $123,000 in payments. So what you do is you just go to openpaymentsdata.cms.gov right there at the top, and you just put the doctor's information, and it will give you just some basic information. It actually goes further than this. But you can find out if the doctor is at all receiving any sort of payments from a pharmaceutical or medical device company. And then the second tab here for payment information, so the summary was this last tab. Payment information actually shows you which companies she was receiving payments from. And so, in fact, actually turns out Bayer's not the biggest one. She's actually receiving a lot more from another company. So that's just information that you should know. This wasn't available before. This only came about, I think it was in 2013. It was called the Sunshine Act. It was supposed to basically shed light on terms of like what the relationship between physicians and pharmaceutical companies, so that you could be aware of any sort of implicit bias that might be created. Okay, so what happens when you do all of this and you still experience an unwanted serious complication as a result of a pharmaceutical drug or a medical device? Well, you have certain legal options. It's really on a case-by-case basis, but I just want to kind of give everyone an overview of what's available to you. So one thing I know when I was talking to my parents about, you know, they didn't, in Iran, is you don't have a jury system. If you're going to have a trial, it's going to usually be by a judge. It's not going to be like it is here, where you have the right to present your case in court with a jury of your peers. It's 12 people of every different nationality, of every different socioeconomic status. It's just everyone. And it's really good because they get to listen to the evidence and they get to judge your case. And so this is something that's unique to the United States, and it is. I know a lot of people have. Has anyone gotten a jury summons where they have to show up in court? I know my dad up here got one, and he was trying to get out of it. And I get one, and I'm like dying to be on the jury. So when you get that, though, I know it seems bothersome, it seems annoying, but it's actually very, very good. It's something that you would want to have people, like, if you were injured and you had a trial, you would want to have people on your jury of your peers there to listen to your evidence. And so I encourage you, next time when you do get the jury summons, you know, try not to get out of it. You might think, for example, well, why not just have a judge hear this evidence? The judge must know a lot more. Well, the judge is going to know a lot more about the law, but they're not going to know any more than you do, at least not at the time of trial, about the medicine, about the science, about the regulatory system. That's not something that judges know. That's something that is presented through evidence. At trial, we present the jury with our side, which we'll have our experts, we'll have the scientific published studies that are relied upon, we'll have the physicians, and we'll have the conduct of the companies, and a lot of times in terms of what they were hiding, what they knew about. So the judges are not any more knowledgeable about this subject. So I encourage everyone to, next time you get it, to please show up. That was basically, I know I gave everyone a lot of information. I hope I've answered, kind of giving you guys the tools that you will need so the next time you go for a doctor's visit. Thank you for your attention, and if you have any questions at this point, welcome.
Questions?
Gentlemen, back.
Is there a way to stop the damage by law to the government channel or not?
So those drugs have, the opioids that are, they have been approved specifically for treatment of pain. I don't know of any other use that they're being used for. And so this is really where it's a decision by your doctor to really now, especially now knowing what we know and how bad the opiate crisis is, and how, especially when kids are being prescribed, you know, an opioid after a simple surgery. I mean, especially how addictive it is at an early age. I think doctors now knowing this are becoming a bit more... not necessarily reluctant, but being a bit more cautious about prescribing it. The FDA, now that it's been approved, you'd have to show that the risks are outweighed by the benefits, and to pull the product off the market. So there are different options of what the FDA can do. So a lot of times, the most extreme action that the FDA can take is pulling the drug off the market. That's not likely to happen with an opioid. What they'll do, though, is they'll put warnings. If you go to the FDA website, for example, they might have an advisory for both patients and for doctors. But they'll also put something on the label itself. But ultimately, I mean, that is something that a decision that you make. It's a decision that it's a recommendation by your doctor, but ultimately it's your decision as well. It's your body or your child's body, and so you can make that decision now knowing what we all know, how addictive it can be, particularly with children. I hope I've answered your question.
So the best scenario is a label from FDA?
Unfortunately, that is what we see most often. So even in the products that we have brought litigation against these companies, most of them aren't actually taken off the market. They're just given stronger warnings. And while that seems like it's not enough, it actually does help, because it causes physicians to take a step back and reevaluate the safety and efficacy. And it also brings to the doctor's attention maybe some research that they weren't aware of when they first started to prescribe the medication. So sometimes you, as a doctor, might, you know, you'll know that this particular drug, you've seen it work well with your patients, so you might be more comfortable prescribing them with that. You might not be tracking how safe and effective it is through published studies. I don't know, for example, how often you check PubMed to search every single drug that you prescribe to see, are there any new studies? So I think with the warning, it does help. Depending on how severe it is, the FDA does oftentimes, though, have letters sent directly to physicians. So they'll post something online and it's an alert that's provided, but then they'll also provide a letter themselves, and they'll also require the companies to send letters to the healthcare provider, essentially warning them of the risks. But what happened, for example, with Bayer and that birth control device that I was talking about earlier, they just pulled that off the market. Now, the thing is a lot of companies pulled their, they really push against having their product pulled off the market, but they're more willing to do that when they have another product in place to replace it. So that's where you see, yeah, so I'm actually surprised that Bayer pulled the product, but I'm sure if I dug a little deeper, I'm pretty sure Bayer either has a device already, in, like a replacement device, or it's in the works. So that's what I would anticipate.
First of all, I'm so proud of you. Such an honor to vote for anything. Right? Okay. So just want to have a question. Right now, if you see the ads, they talk a lot about the goodness of the medication, and then very quickly, like, 20 seconds, they call out all the negatives. So is that something that the companies are using now that you can assume you had told you that this could do that? Does that kind of impact what you're suggesting that kind of closes the door on?
So I do, that's actually very interesting. I did want to show everyone this, and I'm glad you brought this up. I was actually showing my sister this today. Oh, I don't have internet connection.
No, we have Wi-Fi over here. It is open.
Is it this just a Campbell Wi-Fi?
Campbell Community.
Ah, I see. Okay, so I know exactly what you're talking about, but for other people, you might be paying for Hulu and skipping all the commercials for this very purpose, but this is just an example of something that that a laboratory is pointing out, and it's...
Call your doctor if your depression worsens or you have unusual changes of behavior or thoughts of suicide. Antidepressants can increase these in children, teens, and adults.
Can you guys hear? So while you're watching this, you'll see a shift in when they're talking about all the bad stuff. All of a sudden, the person's smiling and everything's all fine and dandy.
Okay, call your doctor if you have high fever, stiff muscles, and confusion to address a possible life-threatening condition. Or if you have uncontrollable muscle movements, as these can become permanent. High blood sugar has been reported with Abilify and medicines like it. In some cases, extreme high blood sugar can lead to coma or death. Other risks include decreases in white blood cells, which can be serious, dizziness upon standing, seizures, trouble swallowing, and impaired judgment or motor skills.
Adding Abilify has made a difference.
You see all of a sudden there? Yeah. So this is, I mean, you are, as a consumer, bombarded with this type of information, so it is difficult for you to... So it really kind of depends what it is that what action can be taken against the manufacturer at that point. because they can say, for example, that there's pain or that there's this risk or that risk. But if you don't adequately inform the physicians or the patients of how likely that risk is, for example, if it's much higher, if you just say pain, well, that doesn't tell me anything. But if you tell me, if you promote your product as only having a 1% chance of chronic pain, well, if it actually turns out that your internal studies showed a much higher level of that, which is often the case, for example, in the litigation I was involved in, it was because of the way that they designed their studies, it showed a very low rate of pain. But internally, they were well aware of the fact that there was a much higher rate of pain, there was a much higher rate for placement surgery, and also in terms of the severity. For example, when you say pain, well, is it chronic pain, is it 2-week pain, that kind of thing. So it's kind of really dependent on what the drug is and what it was being prescribed for that particular patient. And because that, again, goes to the risk-benefit analysis that you do. Trust me when I say a lot of these companies are not saying all these, are not disclosing all these risks because they want to. So that's why they kind of they make it so fast and they make some pleasant image in the back. So people aren't really paying attention to it. So you just kind of stop listening to it. I pay attention to it a lot now just because I find it really interesting how like quickly they go through a coma and death. And it's just like, what am I taking this drug for? So that's just something, it really is a case-by-case basis. But oftentimes, unfortunately, the companies do know.
By knowing that FDA just approved something approved something that by two favorable results without independent study, even those two favorable results could be wrong. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of unfavorable that you mentioned, they don't show. That's how we trust FDA.
Keep in mind the FDA, I mean, their job isn't to test these products. And one thing to keep in mind is the FDA is at the mercy of Congress, essentially, with the budget that they're given. They don't have the resources to test it. And unless Congress enacts a law that gives the FDA the authority to then perhaps mandate that a drug manufacturer release all of the studies. But until that happens, the FDA unfortunately does not have the authority to act. They can't do that. They might try, but they're going to be shot down very quickly by the industry. And that's just a, that's just... The FDA, so one thing that is actually, I didn't go into this, but when I was talking about the budget for the FDA, they are significantly underfunded for all that they do and all that they're tasked to do. But then there's this huge pressure put on them by the industry and by scientists that want the drug put on the market faster. And so what the Congress enacted in 1992 was actually what's called a user fee. So companies, in order to get, FDA didn't have enough money. So Congress required companies who wanted to get their drugs approved to pay it with a user fee. So it sounds like a good idea, except the problem is now the user fees make up 50% of the FDA's budget. So that creates a huge conflict of interest, because how do you say no to a company that's basically funding you, right, when Congress doesn't want to? And you have all this, the FDA keeps getting stripped of its authority for a lot of things. And so, unfortunately, it's going to take action, essentially, by the constituents to push the Congress to give FDA the authority. So I know it's frustrating, but it's what I hope to do, and I think I made it clear, was just because something is FDA-approved, what does that actually mean, Because we get this false sense of security, and we think, well, if it's FDA approved, it must be safe. It must have been proven effective. There must have been years of studies on it. And, you know, and that's just unfortunately not always the case, at least not for off-use, for when we're talking about drugs, and then for medical devices, it's a whole other game.
Is there any lawsuit that you're aware of against the popular medication right now?
Oh, well, yeah, we're involved in a series of litigations. Zofran is one of them. That's actually a litigation that we're currently involved in. GlaxoSmithKline has been heavily, not only had litigation brought by people like my clients in civil litigation, but they've also been criminally charged. But the problem is when you're criminally charged as a corporation, your CEO isn't going to jail. All that happens is you get hit with a really big fine. But when a company is making $2 billion and they're getting fined $2 million, well, it's just a cost of doing business, right? They know that in advance. They know that, okay, well, this is how much I'm probably going to get hit with, but heck, I can make all this money. And the companies, they don't have, unless it's very rarely that the FDA requires a drug to be put off the market. So at best, you get a warning at it. But at that point, the damage has often been done.
So for a drug to be approved, what is the timeline for the FDA to wait until the side effects show up?
Okay, so for FDA approval, so essentially before a drug, there's phases of different phases that a drug trial has to go through. So the first one is really just trying to figure out what are, they do it in a very small population with healthy, it's called phase one. So the first phase is they're trying to figure out, okay, what are the adverse effects in healthy individuals? Okay, so just trying to get an idea of, okay, what could this possibly do? The second phase, and it's very short term, the second phase is when I think that's, it's you then have a slightly bigger population and you're looking at the people who have the actual condition that you're trying to treat. So, but again, you're doing it a very short time period, and at that, in phase two, you're not actually trying to see if any adverse effects, you're really more so trying to figure out what level, what dosage is effective. So that's what they're kind of figuring out in the second phase. And then the third phase is when they do a randomized control study, which means that, you know, you have 100 people, 50 of the people get the new drug, and then the other 50 either get a placebo or another drug. And so that usually has to be done for several years, because it usually does take a lot of years to actually capture the adverse effects. However, again, like I said, that is, they pick their subjects carefully and they exclude a lot of people because that's how they get the numbers to go down for in terms of adverse events, and that's how they drive up their numbers for the efficacy, right? And so that's what they have to do. It does take, for a drug, it is actually quite rigorous. It is several years, and it's a lot of money that gets put into it. After a drug has actually been approved, there's a fourth phase, and it's called post-market surveillance. And what that essentially is that the company is then supposed to then monitor how the drug actually plays out now that it's being introduced to the public at wide. And so that's where you'll really see, okay, what are the true side effects and what are the true benefits of this? Unfortunately, though, 70% of the study, the companies that have said that, or 70% of the drugs that are supposed to be, that were promised to have a post-market surveillance study, they haven't even started the study. And so these are products that have been on the market for years, and they haven't even tried to start the study so that it can be tested. But again, that's different from a medical device. A medical device, it's pretty quick. It's less than half of that price. I mean, you're looking at, for FDA approval of a drug, you're looking sometimes at $30 to $35 million several years. For a medical device, it can be less than $10 million and a much, much faster. Because all they really have to do for a medical device, and I'm not talking about like a pacemaker, if it's something that's supposed to be life-saving, it falls into a different category. But for basically everything else, the other 98% of the medical devices out there, you basically just have to do some engineering testing to see it's, you know, mechanically essentially functioning as a device that was already on the market back in 1976. So, and it might not seem like, oh, well, you're like, well, that's 1976, that's decades ago. How could we possibly be relying on that for a device that's coming out nowadays? Well, what happens is a company, when they're using a predicate device, they don't have to go to the one that first started in 1976. All the other devices that came about after that use that 1976 one, they just get to use that later one. So that's all they have to do. And a lot of times, actually, we've had a litigation where the predicate device has been pulled off the market, but then the other devices remain in play. So.
So for a procedure, I think there is a company that basically tells the patient, I can go inside your heart and disable some muscles to allow your heart to function better. If there's no medication, there is no device. Is there any regulation for protecting consumer on something like that?
So there is no regulatory body that will tell you how to, for example, to perform a procedure. That's really kind of, you know, what's called the gold standard. Usually when you're talking about a surgery, it's, you know, doctors typically go with what's the gold standard. And that's really just a decision to be made by the surgeon, by the doctor. There's no real regulation about that. But what the doctors do have to do, where there is regulation, is that the doctor has to make sure they get your informed consent. So I can't remember I asked this question, but has anyone had a surgery done before? Okay, raise your hands. Okay. You have like a whole bunch of papers, you sign, they ask you to sign here and sign there. Somewhere in all of that is a document called informed consent. It actually outlines the risks and the benefits, okay? It says, Dr. Smith, and basically are going to do this surgery for this particular condition, and then they'll list out the side effects. And it's not an exhaustive list, but it gives you basically the main side effects or complications that can occur from a surgery. And so I know I had someone, actually one of our cousins came to me and said, oh, she experienced something as a result of a biopsy. And I asked her, I was like, well, do you have a copy of the informed consent? And she's like, what's that? And I was like, well, you know, you signed something that had all this information about what you might encounter, what complications you might encounter. She's like, oh, I signed so many stuff. And that's, you know, I don't blame her, because that's what happens. You get so much information, you're about to go through a surgery. It's not really like the time and place for doing. So that's when you do, if you are going to have a surgery done, you want to make sure you have a visit where you fully sit there and you fully discuss the risks and the benefits with your doctor. Because again, you know, your doctor, they only know so much about you. It's your job to give them information about your individual circumstances so that, you know, they're not just looking at you as just, you know, across the board. They can actually see, okay, well, maybe this isn't the right thing for this particular person, you know. But they're not going to know that unless you give that information. So that's also, you know, that's why I'm saying speak up. You know, ask questions, because in all of that, the doctor will learn more about you, and so it will affect his or her risk benefit analysis.
از من یه مقدار سوالم میخوام فارسی بپرسم ببینم که